it's going good. Okay, part two of New Comedy Radio with Sabrina George and Ralph Brown. So you left, or you faded away from the Bill.
Mm.
You'd had enough.
Mm.
Did you go to something, or did you again allow things to just...
No, I just stepped out into the void. I wanted to... I wanted to get into auditioning for movies. I suppose I've met enough people... I don't know where I would have met them, but anyway, I've met enough people who had done a film, and I just was excited by that idea, and that's what I wanted to do.
And Michael was completely supportive, your agent, of that?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, he was very, very happy with that.
So what did you start doing to get into film from
told,
that point?
Told Michael that that's what I wanted to do, you know, and he was probably offering me auditions for things, and I was probably saying, no, I'm not interested by then, for theatre things. I'm sure the Royal Court probably still coming back and other places, and I just said, no, that's it with the theatre now. So then he kind of had to put me out for TV work and film work because that was the only way he was going to make any money out of me. So that would be 1985, I guess, and that's when I got With Nail and I. And the reason why I got that was because they couldn't cast that part. I think they'd seen every single actor in Equity by the time they got round to me.
Why couldn't they cast it?
I think Bruce had a really specific thing in his mind, Bruce Robinson, who wrote the script, and he had not seen anyone who he felt was going to be that character. And Mary Selway, who was casting, had seen me in the Royal Court playing the striking minor and Robert Maxwell and changing my accent a few times on stage. So I was kind of one of those last resorts. Well, there's somebody who can act, you know, clearly.
Different things.
Clearly I'm not going to find somebody who is that character. She tried that avenue and there Bruce had gone, no about that. So then she was getting in actors who were then having to become this person to Bruce's satisfaction. And I remember reading the script and thinking, I have got to be in this. You know, it was just a thrilling...
You didn't know anything about Bruce ahead of time?
Well, there wasn't really much to know. I mean, yeah, I suppose there was. He had an Oscar.
It's always sort of one of those background bonkers characters that...
But he'd done Killing Fields.
Mm.
I don't know if it had come out by then, but it must have done, because that was why they gave him With Now to do. He had an Oscar nomination for Killing Fields for the screenplay. He may have even won the Oscar. Although I'm sure I've been shown it by now if he'd won it. So maybe he did. But, no, I just remember there was a marvellous introduction in the script to Danny saying, you know, this guy's got a jade streak in his hair and get down, punks. This dude is before your time. And sort of stage directions that you never read, you know, is actually the stage directions talking to you, you know. And that's just the way he writes. You know, he writes things like, the music will play until I tell it to stop. And when you're reading his scripts, you get these kind of moments, which is very entertaining.
Have you read the Coen brothers' scripts? They're similar.
Right.
Lots of sort of things that much more, well, not much more, but different from the film, because they've got all these lovely personal bits. Anyway, sorry, carry on. So you were reading these things in the audition?
No, in the audition I tried to learn the scene, which is the first scene. And I remember walking around, it was in High Street Ken, and I remember walking around Kensington Gardens trying to get the first line right, which was, you're looking very beautiful today, comma, man. And thinking, right, well, if I can get that line right, I'll be, you know... Cause
why did you choose that place? I just thought Kensington Market or the remembrance of the market.
Space.
Oh, right.
No, I just wanted empty space and sit on a bench somewhere and just go through it. And I dressed up as well, I put eye makeup on, kind of bandana around the neck and earrings and sort of slightly... I was looking as slightly like David Essex, I recall. Actually, sort of slightly camp version of David Essex.
And was there any resonance with any people you might have met pass by you at the Palace Cinema?
No,
not really.
No, the resonances were people that I knew from my teenage years in Lewis.
Okay.
Where I went to school and people who would pontificate about drugs, particularly dope. People who would... for some reason, there was a guy in my in my town, Lewis, who rolled a joint as long as this table. This table's about 5 feet long. And he just ostentatiously got enough packets of Rizzlers together and got all of the younger kids. This guy had been in prison. He'd just come out of prison for drug, for dope dealing, whatever. He was called Noddy. He was a total casualty, but he was kind of legendary. And he got us all to kind of help with this ridiculous joint and sort of glue all the bits together and then get all the fags out and put all them in it and then get all the weed and put all that in it. It was probably black hash in those days. And that was kind of it really for me. It was that guy and people around his age.
Also, could you describe Lewis a bit? Because I know Lewis a bit and it's quite a bizarre little part of Britain really.
Lewis is, on the surface, a very middle class market town in the middle of very kind of expensive countryside, East Sussex, in the south coast of England. But underneath, if you scratch the surface a bit, there's actually a lot of darkness there. There's a lot of bikers. Well, in my age, in the 70s, a lot of bikers there who used to go to a pub called the Rainbow and drink cider and dance to Status Quo and Hawkwind. There was a big Hawkwind kind of fraternity. There's a kind of witchcraft vibe there as well. Apparently there are these pentagram things on four different corners of the town and they intersect at a certain point.
It's supposed to have the highest population of witches in Britain.
Yes.
Which is sort of bizarre when you drive through it and it's little tea rooms. And
yeah, and then there's the whole November the 5th celebration, which is the biggest one in the UK, where they burn the Pope and various other people and the whole town basically goes up in flame for that night.
Well, during the 80s, there was rumoured to be, I don't actually have factual evidence, a lot of gun running from the coast into London for the IRA.
Right, I didn't know about that.
Mm.
2 years above me in school, there were a selection of drummers, Patrick Frayne, who ended up drumming with me in a band in London, Pete Thomas, who ended up drumming with The Attractions and Elvis Costello, and Andrew Rankin, who ended up drumming with The Pogues and still does. So there were this kind of trio of brilliant drummers just above us, and a lot of musos, a lot of musicians. Guy, when I bought my first saxophone, and it was a kind of leftover hippies. It was like the hippies were still going way into the 70s in Lewis, you know.
And some quite dark elements mixed with this very strange.
Well, these bikers, there's a Hell's Angels thing. I remember going to Lewis Bonfire once and seeing this guy lying on the ground being pissed on by three other guys in front of thousands of people. Like, there was this big bonfire and he was just in front of it and they were just doing it as part of the spectacle. And nobody was stopping them and there was no police there. It was just happening.
Just what happened, yeah.
I was just like 14 years old. It was like gladiator.
Mm. So Noddy turned up in the middle of all this with his joint.
Yeah. Well, no, not that was at a party. That
right. I was going to say, how did he get into your social world then?
Well, because my family was very dysfunctional and kept being split apart, and we all kept having to live with different people. I ended up living with people in Lewis who openly smoked weed, and Noddy was part of that gang of people in the house where I actually was staying. So, 13, 14 was when I started smoking weed.
So that's that mode of speaking and operating was fairly not familiar to you, but you had some reference to it.
Yeah, the idea of
what I'm trying to say is like the impression
given. The idea
given
of being stoned and actually and thinking that you were really bright. You know, that thing of that was where I knew that definitely, especially from guys who are older than me who are just deliberately. You know, this is how pathetic they were. So they're talking to kids who are 3-4 years younger than them, who you know. You wouldn't, would you? I mean, when you're a teenager, you only hang out with people your own age. It's kind of one of the rules. But they're hanging out with people who are younger than them and then sort of lecturing them on things, on drugs and things, you know, whatever. And that's very much what Danny was in that.
Because that's brought up in Central Sussex, and I had endless experiences very similar, and people don't get that I appear to be this very middle class, middle. Mm. And I can slip into that sort of mindset so easily because I was surrounded by it all the time. And I remember, like you were saying, you're sitting there at 12 and some 21-year-old, 25-year-old is telling you some extraordinary stuff to do with numerology and Chinese horoscopes and goodness knows what. And I'd be sitting there, my little brain would be going, this is absolute bollocks. But you could see on their faces there was this real intensity of, yeah, they'd discovered the meaning to life. In fact, there was a guy on King's Road yesterday in a cafe, bunch of people, and they just said, come over and have a drink, and he did that to me, and the guy must be in his 60s, and he said his mother had changed his birthday from the 20th to the 28th of April because of Hitler, and then went on some extraordinary, was it the Dervishes, I think it was. It was a lucky, 28 was a lucky number, and his mother had given him the planets, and by this time I was really lost. And he's still doing it. But I was sitting there going, this is so familiar, and I could just see, yeah. But
Hawkwind were really key, I think, that band, and the kind of, you know, I was taking acid when I was 15, 16, 17, and we'd inevitably end up putting on Hawkwind, which would inevitably freak the shit out of you. It would just, you'd put it on, and it would be like Space Ritual, which is the live album. And there's this section where one of the guys goes, "Think only of yourself. Think only of yourself." And it's just like so dark, you know. And it's about nuclear attack, and so in the event of nuclear attack, we wouldn't ask you to go to the shelters, and there's all this stuff, and there's noises all over the place. And I remember freaking the shit out of me at the time. But that was all kind of normal, you know what I mean? To just walk through the town, you know, looking at all the normal people and going, you know, we're. Jumped out of our heads. Stopped it when I was 19. I couldn't take it anymore. So
at what point were you, even as a teenager, detaching from what your reality was and what these people were talking about, and just going, "This is absolute nonsense. These people are airheads and talking crap." Or did you actually buy into that for a while?
No, I've always had a little kernel of me that was just the observer, and I've never really joined any gangs. I've never joined any. I never liked going down the pub with the lads. Never did that. I'd have one or two friends and we'd get stoned around the back of the pub and drink cider, and I never sort of signed up to anything that I really... I mean, I was a member of the Labour Party briefly, left when they invaded, when they supported the Falklands War. I just thought, I can't have that. You know? So
there you were in Kensington Gardens, one of the most, for those who've never been, how would you describe Kensington Gardens, the most... Royal Central Park in London, where
it's
nannies are seen
Di's
to be.
Garden is, isn't it? The memorial garden for Diana.
And nannies are seen walking lords and ladies as children, and it's terribly sort of aristocratic.
That was me going, "You're looking very beautiful today." "Yeah. Very beautiful today." "No, nothing. That's not right. How are you going to say that?" And I thought, well, I got it. I just got that the man at the end was really not important. It was just something, the way he talked, so it was like, it just kind of had to fall off the end, so it was like, you're looking very beautiful today, no? Oh yeah, that's how it is. And I realised, reading the script that Bruce is writing is very, very specific. He's actually hearing, I mean, all the good writers do this, but he's hearing the line, and then he's writing it down, and so when you actually read it, it's quite, sometimes it's odd, and until you've got the music of it right, it's odd. When you get the music right, it's perfect. And when we were on set doing the film, he would give you a couple of goes at it, and if you hadn't got it, he would come and tell you it in your ear, which is kind of like awful for a director to be reduced to actually saying, it goes like this. I'm like, okay, thanks for removing the only thing I've got left. You know, you're giving me the lines I have to say, you're giving me the clothes I have to wear, you're telling me where to sit, you're putting makeup on me, and now you're telling me how to say it, so... Nothing left for me, really, is there?
Well, who came up with speech impediment?
Me and Bruce.
Right.
It was like a kind of combination of him going, I need you to do something else with it. And it was a kind of partly that he was stoned and partly that he just spoke like that. I think maybe Bruce just went, try that, and I tried it, and he was like, yeah, that, you know. Can't really remember.
Because to me it adds the grotesqueness of it, so you've got this sort of adult with all the black and the scary and the eyeliner and the whatever, and then he's got this almost toddler-like way of speaking, with that speech impediment, the lips coming out and sort of, you know, it's
Lord
something.
Rather than pills to me.
Yes, exactly. So was that a very happy project?
Yeah, it was, and it was everyone's first film. It wasn't exactly my first film. I did a very small part in a film called The Hit with Stephen Frears, but it was the first film where I actually had lines, and it was Richard's first film, it was Paul's first film, it was Bruce's first film as a director, and it was it was one of those things where you thought, oh, this is what making films is like. It's like this. It's all, I mean, you know, Bruce was hitting the vodka at 8 o'clock in the morning, but you would never know he was drunk. He wasn't really, he was just drinking. And it was fun, you know.
And did you have any sense that it was going to be huge, or were you expecting, oh, a few people will see it, it'll open at some of the small cinemas?
I never made a judgment on that. I just thought it was going to be great.
You did?
Yeah, I thought it was going to be great. I didn't have any idea if it was going to be big or small or a hit or anything like that. I just...
You knew it was going to be quality.
That didn't really matter to me. I just thought it was going to be a good piece of work.
Yeah.
And it didn't come out for some reason for 2 years. So we shot it in 85 and it didn't come out until 1987. And I remember, you know, doing whatever the hell I was doing in those 2 years, probably mainly bits of telly. I was probably still doing theatre then. There must have been an overlap. I'm obviously dividing my life up into neat.
It's much easier that way.
But actually, the overlap is huge.
I didn't stop
doing theatre until 1989, and With Nell was 1985. I know that's a fact. It was the 20th anniversary of the release right now. I just remember thinking, you wait till With Nell and that comes out, then you'll see. I remember thinking that for 2 solid years. You know, or any disappointing moment, any time I didn't get an audition, any time somebody ignored me, you know, in a party, or just went, oh, who are you, or just turned the back, or came to a play I was doing and just thought, yeah, that was quite good, you know, that kind of thing. And I'm just...
No, it was in your
you
quiver, in your...
And I never said it, but I just thought it, and it did keep me warm at night. It really did, because I knew it was good.
So how long were you actually on it for, then?
3 days.
Really? Really?
Yeah.
Those scenes, yeah.
Yeah, 3 scenes.
Yeah.
One in bed and 2 in the room.
Yeah.
And the second one's really long. It's just, you know, it's like a 9-minute-long scene. That's a lot of film in one day.
Well, again, I suppose if you're really in the character 100%, it sort of flows along much more.
Well, there's not many shots. If you look at the way it's actually constructed, there's shots missing, really, because I didn't have time to do it. It was a low-budget film, and there's holes in it, in the actual construction of it. Cinematically, you know, there's one shot there, there's one shot from there, there's one of Paul, there's one of the boys there. That's it. That was all we had time to do. And Bruce was very for that end section. Bruce was very keen to get the performances spot on, so we would just keep going until he was happy.
And did you do that in 3 consecutive days, or did you have breaks in between the days of shooting?
I think there were breaks. Yeah, I think there were breaks because they were more or less trying to go in order. So the first scene would have been probably the week before, but maybe they were all in the same kind of week. I remember coming in for a costume fitting or a wig fitting or something when they were doing the scene in Uncle Monty's house. But I was there, I was in that location with them. And we'd been rehearsing in Shepperton, so I'd met everyone and we'd rehearsed and everything. So it wasn't just 3 days, but it was only 3 days on camera. It's kind of mad, really.
Well, consider the impact of that character, because it was a fantastic. So you sort of poddled along for 2 years going, you bastard, you'll wait until Danny comes out, and then what happened?
Jonathan Pryce was extremely kind to me at the premiere, I remember clearly. I was so impressed because he was Jonathan Pryce, the comedians, all that.
Where was the premiere?
In Leicester Square.
Right.
And
red carpet?
Yeah, and afterwards in... wherever it was, somewhere in the corner.
Well, did you come as yourself, or did you come as Danny?
No, I came as myself, yeah. I wouldn't have the equipment to come as Danny, you know. And Jonathan Pryce, I was like, Jonathan Pryce, I'm really pleased to meet you. Hi, how are you doing? I'm really pleased to meet you. It's your night, dear boy, it's your night. Well done. He was still not having any of that, you know what I mean? And I was like, that was when I kind of thought, no. Oh,
something shifted.
Just my night. Yeah. And then Steve Woolley was remembering me back from the, you know, that was what happened then, and I did 3-4 films for him. Scandal, which got mainly cut out because John Hurt was, this is the tale I was told, because John Hurt was drunk the whole time. But I had a really good part in Scandal, which didn't survive the edit. Had 6 scenes cut.
So just to backtrack a bit, when they released Withnall and I,
yeah.
Did the phones go red?
No.
No. It was still a steady climb, even though you...
No, the phones had never gone ready to read them.
So there wasn't sort of lots and lots and lots of scripts coming through with the Danny type character.
I've never had a moment of PR when I suddenly was in the press and suddenly everyone knew who I was. That's never happened. What's interesting, I keep waiting for that to happen to me, and it doesn't. And then what happens is something will be in the paper like, oh, you know, Ralph Brown, you know, who obviously we all know. And I'm like, but wait a minute, I didn't get that bit. I'm now getting the bit which is like Ralph Brown bit, but it's like it's never been...
The bit in the middle, never quite, bit. Yeah.
I never had the article of, here's Ralph, or whatever it is that actors get. I've never had it. I've never felt like I've had it anyway.
Now, I just wonder whether like other producers or directors would send you a slew of scripts which all involved Danny-type characters or whatever. But you had to make a deliberate left turn to get away from that, or not.
This is what happened. I wrote Sanctuary, and Ron Howard wanted to meet me for Willow. And my agent was badgering me on saying, you've got to meet Ron Howard, he's a really top Hollywood director, you've got to meet him, you've got to meet him. And I said, Michael, I'm writing a play, you've got to give respect to the fact that I'm writing a play. And I never met Ron Howard, and that might have made a different turn in my life. Val Kilmer ended up playing that part, but he wanted somebody with long hair, which I didn't have. But
I was going to say, it's the wig, yeah.
So yeah, maybe that would have happened. I wanted to write. So yeah, it was like the focus has never been, until really recently, all one way. I've always sort of had a bit of a scattered thing. You know, I was in a band until I was 25 as well. That was kind of...
It's a backup. Because no, it's just, I've spoken to other people who are in what we now call cult movies, and the impact has been sort of really bizarre, like the Rocky Horror Picture Show people, and they've really had to... I can only describe it as batten down the hatches and hide, because the following has been so rabid and extraordinary. I mean, one of the designers I work with in Australia, he hasn't got a single item left in his house because he's been broken into so many times. And when people hear about it, he's moved into opera now. He's moved right away from all of that because he's got this following which is quite fanatical and out of what I would think a normal person's idea of what can happen. And I wondered whether anything like that had happened also around Danny. Yeah. Nobody's been stalking you or rapidly following you down there.
People have been really respectful. I mean, sometimes I get a kind of, you must be fed up with hearing this, but I thought you were great, and no. That's what I get, that kind of thing.
Right, nice.
Or I get, where do I know you from?
Yeah.
Which is boring, because then you have to go onto the CV, you know, and I've now done like 30 movies and about 70, 80 TV shows, and they want you to just go through them, so they can go, no, didn't say that. Yeah. Oh, yeah, I saw that. Who are you in that? Oh, yeah. What about that? Oh, no, I didn't like that. What was you in that? And I think that's my life. So where do I know you from? I just go down.
Corner shop.
No idea.
Mm.
But I get recognised for the oddest things, you know. But mainly I get kind of semi-recognised. I get recognised because they don't know what something that was just on is. Because I, see, when I started out, and I kind of still hold to this really, I thought acting, because I never had read anything about it really. I did attempt a bit of Stanislavski, I couldn't get through it really. And I always felt that acting was about changing. You know, that was why it was called acting, is because it wasn't being you. You know, that's something I've learned along the way, is that, because I've deliberately, changed my, you know, from one thing to the next, deliberately changed what I looked like, changed what I was wearing, what I sounded like, and tried to kind of be, in some ways, in camouflage. That's why people say, where do I know you from?
Because it's been successful.
Yeah. I can't complain about it. It's been very successful. It's been too successful. Because even inside the business, and people whose job it is to know, still don't know that I was in that film, say, The Crying Game, or that piece of work there. They just don't join the things up. I felt really annoyed about, because I did The Crying Game was it The Crying Game? Or Buster, I did back in the 80s, all those British films I did in the 80s when I was actually turning down theatre work and theatre auditions because I wanted to add films onto my CV, and I didn't care if there were small parts. I just had to build up the CV, and I was doing little one, two scene parts. I remember particularly being annoyed when Daniel Day-Lewis got pats on the back for Room with a View and My Beautiful Laundrette, because there were such contrasting roles, and I'd been doing that. I'd already done that
for ages, yeah.
And more, and nobody was seemed to be picking up on it. It was almost like it was under the radar, and I've always felt like under the radar, frankly. Not quite, obviously, because I've done some things which have been, you know, Star Wars particularly, get tons of fan mail for that.
Is that a completely different sort of vibe to the Withnall and I or the Wayne's World fan base?
Not completely different, but yeah, that, you know, I've done a couple of Star Wars conventions now because they pay well, and my projection of what a Star Wars fan would be like, nerdy, geeky, you know, boring, is actually way off the mark. It's like Star Wars fan could be anyone from anywhere. There's people from literally all around the world. There's people from Argentina, people from Japan, people from India coming to these conventions who are fans of Star Wars. You know, big, small, you know, gay, straight, whatever. It's like there isn't a Star Wars fan that you say that's a Star Wars fan. It's like everyone. So, yeah, life's always a surprise.
Well, my thing in comedy is that a lot of people who do improvisational work are not you know, who do the impro nights.
Mm.
There's nearly always 50% of Star Wars fans doing it.
Yeah.
I don't know why.
How funny.
Yeah. And they find it very difficult not to default to some Star Wars character when asked to improvise.
I'm not a fan of Star Wars in any way, shape or form.
Yes,
I'm
not either.
I quite liked the first film.
They're all right.
But the one I was in was absolutely rubbish. You know, I wasn't invited to the premiere when it was in London, so I've got nothing good to say about any of it anymore. You know.
What was it like working on something so multi-billion, squillion dollar compared to the lower funded projects?
It's you know, it's nice to work on a big budget thing because you get really looked after in a way, and you get time to do it properly. But then there's a sort of huge distance from it as well in a way. You're not sort of intimately connected, and I don't think George Lucas is one of those people that likes talking to actors anyway, so he never felt really involved in it like you do with any of the British films and the Steve Woolley films and stuff.
And what about Wayne's World?
Well, that's an exception. That was just a fantasy job. That was a fantasy job. That was my joke coming true. My joke of, oh, that'll be Hollywood on the line. Pick up, oh, hello, Mum, you know. And then, you know, one Friday night at 11 p.m. it was Hollywood, and it was my agent. I had an agent by then. I'd done Alien 3, and I'd gone over to LA after the director suggested that I should. Got an agent, and the agent in America had phoned up and said, Paramount Pictures want to fly you out on Sunday. And that was for Wayne's World 2. And when I read it, I thought, this is written for me. This isn't written for anyone else. And they kept saying, oh, Robbie Coltrane, who's actually Robbie Coltrane, is going to play this part. And I thought, oh, really? I thought, nah, mate, this is Danny from Withnail. This is so, you know, the reason why Keith cannot be killed by conventional weapons. It's like written in that vernacular. But that was a fantasy gig because it was like fantastic money, fantastic makeup. I had to get to work at 2 o'clock every day in the middle of the night and get all the tattoos painted on. Had great lines, you know. I was working with Christopher Walken and Kim Basinger.
Tough gig. Yeah.
It was all good.
Yeah.
It was all good.
Yeah.
And it was a good movie, and it was funny.
Yeah.
And I got a great review, and I've often wondered whether that review in the LA Times, which said that I walked off with the whole film, stopped me working in Hollywood. Nobody wants
somewhere to walk off of the movie.
Yeah. Steal
their movie.
Yeah. Yeah. I've often thought that was too good, that review.
Yeah.
And they take notice of that kind of stuff over there.
And did you spend much time in LA generally, or were you just literally going in there for a few days?
Yeah.
You were.
Yeah, we moved there in 92, and we stayed there till 95. And yeah, so I spent quite. And then went back in 2001 for a couple of years. I spent about 5 years of my life there. Enjoyed it.
Okay, let's stop there and then we'll go on to.